What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Gosh, I got no pre-rolls to read, but I have just so much to talk about. Toby, what a wild day. I got to tell you, maybe three things are going on with me today that are overlapping to create what I feel is one of the best days of my life.
Oh, my God. One of the best days of your whole life.
Well, I mean, I'm just really enjoying today. I mean, I'll tell you what they are. The first one is just the week's end special. It sounds great. I already know it's great.
Right.
I know people is going to be well received. So we have a rock concert tonight where I'm going to enjoy it from home in the best possible way. And I'm already super confident of how well it will be received. And that feeling is huge. So I'm beaming about that because I've approved the final. It feels great. It's great. So that's – and there's – I could talk endlessly and won't about that one, but to encap 17 years to the day the week's end came out today. Do you remember that day?
Yeah, not really.
I do. I remember it really clearly, but I won't even go through. That's not the time for that. That's not what I really want to talk about today. But that is super exciting. So I hope everybody will do that. The other is Francis Sopper on the podcast today. That's one of is probably the greatest treat for me because it wasn't even on my radar. He's somebody that I intensely look up to and am curious about and didn't even think we should try to have him on the podcast. I feel like I haven't even begun to really understand enough. And then here you go, pop, and just get him on the podcast all of a sudden. I'm like, holy crap, I get to talk to Francis Sopper. So this one's exciting to me in that way. Same way.
Who is he? Robin.
Well, so Francis Sopper is a guy who I found through a secondary way from this book. I can't even explain it, but he does cognition work, and he is an older person who's been thinking about the types of things that I like to think about for his whole life.
Right.
And so I feel that he has much knowledge that I'm interested in. I ran across him recently because he made a cognitive test that you take that helps you assess things. So I think he's very, very powerful in the non-labeling of respecting many types of brains.
Right. I'll say it this way. For a very long time, we've kind of shit on the Enneagram. I felt like it's a fad. Something about it kind of bothers me. And this survey that he created helped me to understand my brain a little bit more real way. For me.
Yeah, but the survey isn't – it's just a tool that he has created to do the work that he does. He's not it's not like – anyway. So
but
we'll talk about the survey and just who he is as a person is really exciting. So that's big.
Right.
I just had a fun thing happen to me on the way back from dropping off Jerry at preschool where I almost had a car wreck.
Oh, God.
And, you know, that can be really exciting.
Yeah.
Know? All of a sudden I'm sitting on the side of the road, like in the median all of a sudden and realize what just happened. Like, there's some weird, I have weird brain processing, but whatever it was, I reacted unbelievably perfectly and calmly. And my mind never turned on. Like my other part of my body that I don't communicate that well with, just handled the situation. Like, I was just thinking, and then all of a sudden, I'm sitting, like, on the side of the road in a median, and the cars around me are, like, looking at me and thumbs up to me, like, for the maneuver I had made. Like, it was a scary situation where I slammed on the brakes and kind of went to the median, but there's oncoming traffic, and there was a car that had – it took me until after to process it from my mind, but a car pulled out trying to go around a bus but into my lane. But then there's oncoming traffic in the next lane over. So all I could just hit the brakes and kind of go to the middle, whatever it was. The people around me thought my maneuver must have been good and were like – thumbs up and smiled. Then by the time I look and that car's going around, it's a student driver, you know, and I'm sitting there in the car. And this is the part that I like the most that unlocked a little bit of self-understanding for me is I was smiling. I thumbsed up the people back, grin on. I mean, there's never, not even for a millisecond, did I feel nervous or angry or any emotions at all. It was, and I promise you, and I had Cosmo in the back seat. My heart rate changed zero. I guarantee, I wasn't wearing my watch, but I guarantee you it stayed right at 55 beats per minute. Nothing. It just, and I just thought that was so great. And then I feel so good because nothing makes me happier, I guess, than being calm in chaos. I just love that feeling. I love my body to be keyed up. It's like I'm excited today. Things are up. My body is intense. There's chaos. And I just like being calm in that for whatever reason. It's like it seems that I like the feeling of my body being keyed up. I think other people don't. They call that anxiety. But it doesn't make me feel anxious.
Right.
I think for most people that makes their minds then become uncomfortable. But I can have my body be all tense about stuff for real, and then I can just sit here on top of it with the other half of my brain and enjoy the energy and motivation that I have. So that's the way I feel today. And none of that is what's really exciting today. Everything that's exciting today is happening in the stock market.
I know, it's insane.
I really want to talk about, and I'm sorry to talk over, but Toby, you're the oracle. I beseech thee, oracle, to tell me about your ways. This is such an exciting day, and I'm not going to play the audio back, but on the bonus episode, not a week ago, you're talking up AMC stock, and we have an argument about how it can't double. It would take probably 2 or 3, 4, 5 years to double, and it goes up 10x in the week, and Devin bought it. And the whole thing that's happened in the market just really deserves some discussion before Francis gets on. So this will be a long episode. I hope y'all enjoy it, but it's a good one for me.
Yeah, I just I don't know what made me think of it. I was just like, you know what? I wasn't following anything or following gurus or anything. I just like, you know what? AMC, we got a new president and they're gonna start opening stuff back up more, vaccines. So I said, I bet it could at least go up. So let me take a look at it. I was like, oh, it's only like $2.20. I said, that probably would be a good one. I looked at the all time high was, $15, maybe it's $30 or something. I don't remember. And it had been $7 for a long time, and it was down all the way down to $2. And I was like, huh. And you made fun of me on the bonus episode. If you're not in the BC Club, join it because you hear a lot more content. But and I was talking to Devin about it.
What did you understand my position to be in your position at that time? That I was saying,
it was the position is always Toby's playing the lottery.
Yes,
and Matt hates the lottery. That's
what
it always is.
Different than investing, but yes. But I mean,
right.
I found it laughable. You were saying your argument, I thought, was relatively simple. It was, well, this is very cheap. It's only worth a couple of dollars. This AMC stock. To which I say, that's because it's a shit company in big trouble. That's its value. It's $2. And you're like, well, it has to just double from here. How wouldn't it? It's AMC. And I'm like, but that's why it's priced at $2, because it's on the way down. So don't know if it's going to go up.
But I thought it has to go up some, I thought, just because people will want to go back to the movies. No matter what, there is going to be something where people have to get out of their houses and go do stuff. You're working from home. Your family's at home all stuff. Man, can I go at 9 o'clock by myself and go watch a movie or something?
That's not what caused it to 10X.
No, it's not. So my theories weren't the reason why. It's just that everybody's like, fuck all these Wall Street tycoons so Wall Street buys these companies that are collapsing to make money. They put in unbelievable amounts of money.
I'm curious though, did you not have any tip on AMC that was pure, or you're not on those Reddit threads and the GameStop stuff?
Like, I didn't even know.
I thought when I got up this morning and saw it that you had been getting like crypto goofy.
No.
Whoever does that kind of stuff. From
I heard about a whole different stock. I was flipping through TikTok and heard about another stock called I forget what it even was, but it doubled too. But that was the only one I heard. I just thought AMC. I was just thinking about stocks, and I was like, I'm just going to look at that one, because I knew Regal went out of business as well, out of business. So I was like, well, it's the only one, and there is property, and it is set up to show movies. So that was just an intuition. There wasn't, and none of the what's happening today. Right now, I think I just looked it up. It's going from $2.20 last week or whatever to $20 this morning.
Yeah, 10x today. I mean, so basically, we're at the territory of discussing what's happening in total here with the GameStop, and this and the other stuff, which involves the short selling and whatever's going on. Do you understand that what's really happening? I mean, this is a very, very new, unprecedented, volatile very exciting, likely chaotic, likely likely negative things that are going to happen to many people in many ways. And that's, again, this is that chaos of, like, this is the all these anomalies that you keep seeing in the last year and so are all, they're funny now. And when there'll be some time when we look back on all this and go, oh, that was when that started. Oh, that's when that started. That's when that's changed over. We're in that time of, and this is, these are funny, interesting, notable, and will be historical things that'll be looked back on when things started to do like they're doing now.
My knowledge of stock doesn't go that far. So what I guess I don't totally understand, but here's what I feel like I know. Some hedge fund puts up a bunch of money because the stock is going under, and I don't understand how that helps them. If the stock's going under,
I can't wait to explain it.
Okay. So they do that, but somehow everybody gets on Reddit and is like, no, let's fuck this company. Let's fuck Wall Street and screw them over, and they're going to be out. So that whatever hedge fund was doing that with GameStop is screwed right now badly, probably, right? So maybe you can explain a little bit better.
Okay, so what is happening here is, like, it's the internet has empowered, you know, just people to aggregate themselves and then make big crypto. People have been doing this for a while, a little bit. So crypto is volatile. People compare it to the tulip bubble of whatever, you know, it's just, it's trading at its value, but it can be all hyped up. And there's things called pump and dump. Have you seen the movie Boiler Room?
Yep.
You know,
yep.
where they pump and dump stocks. So they talk a bunch of big whales into buying a stock so that it goes up. And then they get a bunch of small fish from these phone scams and get them to buy it. And then they all sell the stock, but they owned it before they pumped it up. You know, and so if you get enough people to pump the stock, you can just pull your shares before
penny
it crashes on
stuff,
them or whatever it is. Yeah. So that starts to happen in cryptocurrency and stuff, where these Redditors and people and I don't really follow or understand crypto, you know, Twitter, but they basically can get enough public movement to go so that it can inflate. But then as long as you're the one inflating it and you pull out before that little micro bubble, that's what high volatility does. So you just, if you're the one pushing it, you have a giant Twitter account and you can actually affect the market enough, then you'll know how to pull out on, you know.
Right.
Now the stock market, that's crazy crypto, dark web, evil,
right,
all that stuff. So
decentralized.
That's fine. Yeah. And so everybody was like, whatever about that. But now those types of strategies and those things have worked their way over into the fiat currency, Wall Street, mainstream thing, and it's gonna really make people nervous, because now it's just like this narrative stuff that is able to work its way into these markets that the stock markets and the brokers and the hedge funds and the fucking money people that a lot of people think are the worst people on earth causing most of the problems are going to be affected. But
right,
it's going to be volatile if this type of thing begins to work and work more, and how it's going to re-regulate and what it means for the futures of currency and investing is big. It also comes at the time when they're about to open up micro investments to people. Do you know that? I will get back to the exact stock thing in a minute, but all this territory is important because it all kind of converges. You know how they're going to be soon allowing micro investors to invest in startups, like IPOs kind of thing?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like they don't have traditionally, the big money system doesn't let the little guys get in early. That's always been one of the ways that they say, and they say it's to protect the little guy. That's what
right,
they say.
Right.
But really, it's only rich people can play at the high stakes tables where you can win. So in real estate, you got to have a bunch of money to get in. Even the stock market, you can't really, I mean, you can trade stocks, but in the investing in new companies directly like that, they're going to open it up so startups can start taking micro investments under, you know, before you'd have to prove that you have this big account and you're worth
right.
get certified by all that. So all these things together are going to upset some of these bubbles and monopolies that Wall Street and the financial institutions and the hedge funds and stuff have. That's kind of the battle that is gearing up. So that's just going to be – I mean, there's going to be huge people that lose so much money on both sides, and it's going to be wild. I mean, it's going to be wild, the future financially. Not to mention,
if the system lets people do it.
Crazy. That's what I'm saying. That war is
going
to be crazy.
There literally might be a war. I already saw it today watching AMC. I mean, they stopped trading several times.
That's what I'm saying.
And I was like, how do they do that? They're doing that. They say to protect people. They're trying to fuck people over.
Protecting rich people.
Right. Right. I mean, they really are trying to do that. They're trying to protect everybody. If we stop it, if we make a pause, it's like calling a timeout in a football game. You stop the momentum if you can. It's the exact same thing, right? And so it's just, I mean, it's really fucking people over. And I'm telling you, we are living in, war sounds so intense and like maybe the wrong word to use, but
that's
I mean,
not the wrong word,
the,
no.
the, it'll be the new war. It's coming.
Of a cold war, or it might even be a hot war, but it's not a physical hot. I mean, you know, we're going to have new terminologies for wars. Like people talk about culture war. That's a, you know, it's a real war.
Right.
Of some type. So, you know.
Yeah. And so it's all going to change. I mean, it is hilarious how volatile and scary it is. But I mean, I don't know. It's just, I mean, it's gone up and down all day today. I've just been watching it and I was like, man, you know. And so I wish I had more of the heart for it. Devin does.
You don't want to play in this. Trust me.
No,
I
don't.
It's really funny that you have the ability to just, you know, look, I give you all the credit in the world. And that is why I am friends with you, is because I'm doing the things that make sense. I am making calculations and projections, and I love to just explain it to you. But there's nothing makes me happier than when you're actually right and I'm wrong about something new or crazy.
Yeah.
I'll switch immediately. I mean, I'm an idiot. I know nothing. Yeah. You know, now, meanwhile, I'm not buying AMC. I'm just going to chill. I'm not getting involved in any of this casino.
Man,
I think
you're
it's the
so
craziest
lucky
thing
you don't
in
have
the world.
You don't have that FOMO, man. I have
no,
that FOMO. I have the FOMO, and also when I buy it, I immediately have FOMO of missing out on my money. Like,
but you don't understand.
Immediate.
I'm the institutional elite. My grandfather gave me $10,000 that I'm never going to spend, and eventually it'll be worth $1 million. That's what I'm doing. I'm not ever going to take the money out, and I'm never going to spend it.
Right.
So that's why it doesn't intersect with the people who like to do all the stuff you are interested in.
Which
that's what I'm saying. That's
I
so
came
exciting.
From my dad's played the lottery every week for 10, 15, 20 years. I mean, that's just, you know what I mean? It's exactly what it is.
The lines are blurring between those two. Anyway, I love that, but I'm not in any way interested in carrying my life savings into the casino in my fanny pack.
Right.
Personally, not something I would
I'm
do.
Not that either. I'm not that either. But I would love to have a little bit more disposable income where I could just
that's
sling it around and not care.
It.
But nope,
no,
I know.
You could play games with it, give yourself $1,000, go hog wild, and you could get lucky. I mean, there's no
right.
Obviously. But so what's going on here? The way this works is, you know how if you invest in stock, there. In a sense, it's gambling, but typically a stock's only going to go down 1%. So worst case scenario for some big stock or whatever, you buy a premium stock, it's going to go down some percent, you would sell it. It's not like you would even lose all your money. Now, if you do risky stuff and invest in bad companies or extreme rare things happen, and you never sell because you're so stubborn and you chase it all the way to the bottom, it is possible to own stocks and things and ride it all the way down to zero, where you could literally lose all of your money. And that sounds crazy. It's not like the casino where you can lose it in a single roll. But if you were stubborn enough, in theory, you could lose your money, all of your money in stocks.
Completely,
typically, when people have big stock losses, they're, you know, just a percentage decrease.
Right.
So now, short selling is the key term here for what this phenomenon is that has been exploited forever and now a weapon against. Okay, so short selling is like this relatively risky thing that people do to bet against bad companies, drive companies' values down on purpose, get people out of their jobs, and hope the business goes bankrupt so that they can make a lot of money. It's betting against a company. It's being at the craps table and everybody's, you know, it's whatever's going on, you bet against the shooter with the dice.
No to the pass line or whatever.
Yeah, don't pass line. Right.
Don't pass line.
So you if you think that the company is going to fail and the stock price will go down, then you agree to buy shares of that stock at a future price. You basically borrow shares that you are going to sell, that you're going to buy. You commit to buying shares later, basically. So you borrow the shares now, and you will pay the price for them later.
Okay.
So by the time that you have to pay the price, it'll
way
be worth
down.
Way less because the company's tanking. And by you engaging in that, you're going to further devalue it, basically.
Okay.
So these hedge funds can push companies downward and then profit off of that. So it's seen as leechy, in a sense, right?
And now, so that's why everybody, But on a side note, on this topic, that's why everybody's saying this is the retail industry fighting back.
That's
right.
Correct.
Because they're saying GameStop in a way.
GameStop's over. AMC's over. You know, Express at the Mall, which is a company I've been complaining about because I buy their T-shirts, and they've been horrible. I mean, they're horrible. They're not managing online well at all. I already knew that. And then now their stock's going up. So there's a little the game on it is like, okay, so here's what's so crazy about short selling, why it's so risky. Because remember, in a regular stock, you could lose at most all of your money.
Right.
But when you short sell, there's no limit to how high the stock can go, and you're committed to making the purchase.
Right.
So not only can you lose all the money you have, you can lose way more than you put in. Way more. You like if the stock goes up 10 times, like if you bought that at $2 and it goes to zero, you lost 1,000 shares at $2.
Right.
$2,000. But if it goes up 10 times to $2,000, now you're committed to buying a super inflated thing and you get a bill for way more than the original $2,000. Now you got a $20,000 bill.
Right.
When you didn't ever have 20,000. All you have, I mean, they have to have a certain amount to play that game, basically.
Sure.
So, you know, but nonetheless, they're obligated to cash out at the high price, which can be multiples of what it originally was. Whereas when you lose money, you just can lose what you put in.
Right.
So you're actually, it's like buying on credit in a way where you can get stung unbelievable. And so now these people have really put this momentum to fight back to drive up the price of something that was targeted by these people as short sales, and it stings them in these unbelievable ways and then inflates this thing. And now it's off and runaway. So now everybody playing the game is just playing some spin until it maybe inevitably goes down or whatever. I mean, everybody thinks it'll inevitably crash because it's untethered from the company, which actually sucks and is not going to.
Right.
Nothing about the stock price has anything to do with the company at this point.
So the
now you have this pure thing that's up there spinning with winners and losers, unbelievable chaos.
That's what I was getting ready to say. There'll still be regular people losers in this
because
they bought
tons.
In. So the way you have to play the game is to know when to get out. So at some point you should take the winnings, even if it still doubles or whatever. You got yours, but yes. I mean, there's people. There was a guy in the club talking. I forget who it was. I was scrolling. Said he bought in at GameStop at like $70 or something. It might have been Brett. I thought it was somebody. It might have been Nick.
Brett the Butthole Wilson, I believe.
It might have been, but it might have been Nick or I'm sorry, I can't remember. But they bought in like $70, and it went to $300. You would have thought buying GameStop at $70 is the foolish, most stupidest thing you could have done. And man, doesn't he wish he bought more? That's the thing. Don't you wish you bought more?
But he was riding a bad stock all the way to the bottom. And then this thing, I mean, get out, sell it. I mean, come on. I mean, this is a goal. You know, there's no good advice of how to do it or to ride it. And the people that are telling you it's going to go higher are the people that want to make sure they get out right before you. So think of it that. But overall, whatever the public decides is going to happen with that stock is what will happen.
Right.
So as long as you cause 10 more people to go buy it, your pyramid scheme will work for at least temporarily. And that's how the whole economy works, actually. And so it brings the whole thing into this everybody's mind. Like, everybody's about to understand how all this stuff works more and more because it's going to really have big effects on how they regulate. I mean, probably bad. The government probably swoops in and fucks everybody that's poor more, you know,
right.
Or, you know, the money figures out a way, basically. But it's so fun when these chaotic events happen.
Well, that's what I was getting ready to say. The government will still protect the fucking rich people, because you know what they'll do? They'll just, you know, if you buy a stock and take it out in less than a year, you have to pay more in capital gains. So you already had to pay more of the money, just like the lottery. If you take the big chunk, you got to pay more of it. You don't get the $1 billion. You get maybe half of that or something like that. So there's going to be a lot of people that maybe will even walk away with some of this, but they might even just raise the taxes on it. Oh, well, you're going to play this game.
Capital gains
are
less than income tax, though.
Sure, but
it's a loophole for rich people. I mean, that's how they make their money, and it taxes less than what I get taxed.
But I'm saying the way you do your stocks, if you hold it for longer than a year, it's less in capital gains. So 1 year is already still more. Like, if you play the game of the quick pump
short
and
term,
dump stuff, short-term stuff, then you get fucked more. And they might just do it even more in the future. I mean, the rich people are rich and going to stay rich.
You're right.
You don't have to worry about them.
All they do is cause their immoral activities to be technically legal. That's how money works. That's what it does. It legalizes immorality on their part because they can. until right. there's some way to challenge it, which this is one of those. It's an immune response yeah. to this badness that exists.
I saw a video of Dave Portnoy, though, talking about somebody, you know, on MSNBC, and was complaining, this is not how stocks are done. People are ruining
yes.
it. And those fuckers are the worst
exactly.
people, leech people,
yes.
gross people that on
Elite
earth.
Bubble people.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're terrible people. And the regular guy's the bad guy because he
exactly.
got in on something.
Yes.
I mean, get the fuck out of here.
Now, the little guy is going to get fucked is what they'll say. They'll say, but yeah. the little guy's the one that's actually going to get fucked. You need us and more regulation to protect them. I understand. That will always be the narrative. That's the narrative for everything. Is
right.
We need to save you from yourself. Okay. Got it. I've been told that my
right.
whole life. But let me ruin my life. Please let me. Please let
right.
me.
Right. Don't I get to choose my own way? I mean, I'm
Please.
So fucking stupid that I need some yeah. idiot on, you know, at JP Morgan or whatever telling me how to fucking do my life.
I wish they could short
the
sell me. Yeah, I'd make them that offer.
Oh, now we got to just now we just got to make Bad Christian an IPO, right?
We'll make our own coin, yeah.
I want Bad Christian to be a stock. Let's pump it and dump it.
I mean, any respectable cult will eventually have its own form of currency. So.
Yep.
All right, I tell you what, I'm excited for Francis to join us in a minute. I already told you why. I hope everybody will come see our special tonight. But before that, let's listen to a little bit of music as we get Francis piped in here. You're listening to I Will Fail You. We heard it before, and yes, it's Demon Hunter.
These quiet words, they carry me away. Returning, they keep coming back.
All right, you're listening to I Will Fail You, one of the songs from Demon Hunter's upcoming project, Songs of Death and Resurrection. And upcoming, I think you might even get it right now. But anyway, check it out. Songs of Death and Resurrection is a collection of beloved, and I'm talking about beloved, Demon Hunter songs that have been reimagined into acoustic arrangements featuring the full band, string sections, and lots more. To pre-order the record, head to demonhunter.live to find exclusive shirts, box set vinyl, and more, or head over to Solid State Store for their vinyl variants as well. I Will Fail You and Dead Flowers are the singles currently available, but many more are on the way, so go follow the band's Spotify and Apple Music pages so you don't miss anything. Songs of Death and Resurrection is available everywhere on March 5th. Pre-order now.
Excellent. This is one of those things that Ryan Clark does really well. He's a big fan of Alice in Chains, and I was listening to Alice in Chains Unplugged. That series from MTV is so good. And Alice in Chains did it particularly well, and I know that's a big influence yeah. on Ryan, and this is like, you know, it's really great. So I think that's really cool stuff that people are doing music these days. So just keep open mind, especially these higher-level productions that are on top of albums are very, very exciting. Thank you, Toby. Hope y'all like that song. Okay, let's see if we got Francis.
Here we go. I I had it on the computer mic, and now it's on the good one. It should be.
You're comfortable, can hear us, and do you have an hour to chat?
Sure. Yeah.
Excellent. I imagine you're good with time management, given your set of skills. I don't know how that works, but I find guys like you seem to be accomplishing a lot, but yet very flexible minute to minute, I find.
Well, I actually don't have a hard out, so.
Perfect. Well, Francis, we're glad you're here, and you're from Kairos Cognition. And this is what's kind of cool about this. So I'd never heard of this before at all. Matt, you found this. Now, what's funny about it is, Francis, I used to work at a church in Charleston, South Carolina, and our pastor, Pastor Ron,
he would always use the word kairos. He would use it all the time. And I was like, uh-oh, Matt's sending me some Christian stuff. Yeah. Like, I thought it was something from, you know, Matt founded a church or something like that. But, it, you know, then I saw the cognition part. I was like, well, maybe there's something a little bit to this. But, Matt, I'm used to, like, if I'm going to do a survey or something, it always has to be kind of fun or silly or not really going to apply to me that much because I just want to disprove it. So I'll do some of them. Or the silly ones like cosmopolitan ones or something, you know, that says this or that about yourself. Then I go, look how stupid this is. Don't you understand all these things are crazy? We did this one. Matt sent this one to me, and I was blown away. I was like, wow, this is serious. Matt, how'd you even find this?
Well, I mean, I've been on a little bit of a journey of becoming aware of metacognition as an intense interest of mine that maybe it's kind of always been there. I've just never really had the exact awareness of it or need for it or know how to think about it or talk about it. So I'm kind of on something like the beginning of a journey of this in my mind. But there's a roundabout way where I wound up encountering this. But I'd like to start just to get to know Francis a little bit. I'll tell you more about me as we go. But Francis, how does somebody like you come to be in this field of metacognition at this point in life and do the things that you do? It doesn't sound like any job or career or type of thing that I'm very familiar with what you do.
Yeah. It's kind of been invented as I've gone along. So, I originally got interested, I just born curious. That's just the way it was. And so I'm always following my interests, want to learn something, want to figure stuff out. And it's at some point when I was in college, I did all the coursework for four different majors, only wrote a thesis in one because, you know, I ran out of time, but I just wanted to learn everything.
What were those four topics? I'm curious what types of interests you had describing yourself that way.
I started with economics, and that's what I wrote my thesis in, but took the coursework for geology, English, and history. And it was just because I was interested in everything. And, you know, I actually grew up in the Boston slums and in those neighborhoods that when you go, if they're like movies like The Departed or.
Oh, really?
In The Departed, when I watched The Departed, I could put names to every one of those characters.
Oh, wow.
I grew up with all these people, you know, and, I don't know if you remember the name of Jack Nicholson's character.
I don't recall the character name, but I know the movie and enjoyed it. I'm glad to hear it was accurate.
His name was Francis.
And, oh, that's right.
And he was actually named as I was. That character was named as I was for my great-grandfather, who was one of the founders of the Boston Irish mob back at the turn of the 20th century, the beginning of the 20th century. So you know, I came out of, you know, that kind of underworld. My paper route took me from the Irish neighborhood through the Hasidic neighborhood into the Black neighborhood. And that just allowed me to be curious about everybody. And then when I went to college, they had all the food I could eat and all the books I could read. So I felt like I'd gone to heaven.
But is it to you, is the kind of thing where you're just interested in consuming lots of information, you know, in wide data sets? Is that kind of how it feels?
Yeah. And I have no idea why. Everything looks interesting. I go to a new country and okay, now I want to learn this language, you know. So when I graduated from college, I thought, well, I want to, I was interested then in, yeah, I didn't really have a subject line. So what was I going to study if I went to more school, you know, even though I love living in a place that had endless food and endless books, you know, I had to figure out how to make a living. And I didn't have any specialty. And so I decided, well, I want to figure out how humans acquire language. And then I get interested in how humans acquire reading. And so then I decided, okay, I want to learn more about this. I want to teach. So I actually had no teaching credentials, but talked myself into a teaching internship at a rural school in Maine, and was working with high school kids, and got to work with a high school class where kids were in high school and had never learned to read. And so we were teaching them how to read. And so, you know, what's this about? You know, how, you know, why is this so easy for some people and so hard for other people? And I realized working with high school kids was too late. So so I decided, I actually went into a program for elementary education, again, with no prior credentials. And talked myself into that program. It was a master's program. And it was in, so I was teaching third grade in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and was just really interested in, you know, all the things that these kids could do, but then some kids really had a hard time doing certain stuff. And you know, my colleagues would say, oh, they're, you know, that one's lazy. And I said, there's nothing lazy about that kid. I've seen him do all kinds of stuff. Right. And pay attention to all kinds of stuff. But he's not reading. And so started to dig into that. And while I was doing that, I thought I was being invited to be a participant. I now realize that I was a research subject. So there was we were within a short distance of the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and I got invited to participate in a couple of projects. One, they had a psychologist named Howard Gardner, who had just published a book called Frames of Mind. And he was the first person to really go public with the understanding that our brain wasn't a single processing unit, but it was really a collection of processes that did different things and more or less communicated with each other. And that more or less communicate with each other was the most interesting part of that. And then I was assigned to a project where we're studying how boys and girls learn math. And then I was assigned to another project where they were trying to figure out how to use desktop computing as a tool in education. And really just was got involved in why this kid who could do just about anything was struggling to read. Got the idea, we had just gotten our first photocopier. This tells you how long ago all this stuff was. And I realized if I could blow up a page of text, cut the text up, blow it up again. Yeah, this photocopier allowed you to double things at that point. Paste it on a piece of paper so there was it was big enough and there was enough space around it that this kid could read perfectly. We found out that he wasn't lazy. He had a non-degenerative muscular dystrophy, which created an upper body weakness in his muscles. And his eyes just fatigued. You know, reading regular size text was like running a marathon for him. And he just fatigued. And as soon as we blew it up, he was able to read. And so I started looking at all kinds of stuff. You know, what is the thing that's keeping this person from doing the thing they want to do?
Right.
Now take it forward. The survey you took, have you ever seen The Big Short?
Yeah.
Okay. You know how the Christian Bale character, you know, kind of listens to thrash music and he's going through all of these minute mortgage-backed securities.
Right.
Well, I did that with educational testing. When I saw the movie, I thought, oh, my God, I am as big a nerd as, as Christian Bale's character. Mine was probably rhythm and blues and not thrash, but it was, unpacked thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of educational testing and all of the minute data looking for patterns. And those 53 questions you got are the distillation of that work.
Okay. That's tremendously interesting, and I don't know your history, so that's been very helpful to me, but it makes me feel even more confident of the reason I resonate with your work, I guess, because I share some things with you in some of those ways you already described to a lesser degree. So we arrive at the survey you've made that's born out of this, and to me, that just off the top, like Toby was saying at the beginning, if you arrive at this study, this research, this questionnaire, this thought process, it can be compared to a quiz thing on the internet about your whatever thing, or Cosmopolitan, or the Enneagram, or astrology. If you just browse some of the things, you could see that. And I've always had a very intense dislike for most of those things because I do not find them mechanical, and I know that they're not from the bottom up. Yeah. I know that they may contain truths, they may help people, they may show people things about themselves and do many discovering things, but your work and the work of David Allen, when I encountered it, I immediately understood it 100% on each sentence. Sounds intentional. It sounds like I wrote it. It sounds like it's written by in the language that I speak natively, not regular human speak the way people talk. I don't know how to describe that phenomenon, but it's just a very distinct one. It just seems like all the words that you guys write are precise and very intentional, and they aren't written in my native language. And so all of a sudden, something that sounds like a quiz like the Enneagram, which I can't really even allow myself to do, all of a sudden I'm open to this self-analysis because I trust it. I just have a familiar trust with it, so I'm able to engage with it. So find that very fascinating. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that reaction from me.
Real quickly, too, my listener is 67%. I'm sure we'll talk about it in a minute, but I think your mic might still be a hair hot. I'm hearing a little bit of a buzz in my ears. Can we fix that real quick? I don't know if he can turn down just a tad. Or are you?
Does that have an input gain?
Are you for sure you're on your mic? Maybe tap on it and see if we can hear it. Because it sounds like you might still be on the room mic. I'm just getting a buzz, and this is so good. I don't want to. Yeah, I don't want to mess it up. If we can just take a second.
Take a second. We'll get it.
Yeah, I'm still on the MacBook mic.
Okay.
How's that one?
Oh, there we go. Whew. All right.
All right.
What one of the questions you asked in the results, it says, how much time do you waste listening to people chew? And that one got me. I was like, oh my gosh, that is like, I just hear these things. And then I'm like, you said, like how I'm processing the information and how I'm managing it with that, it really does. Like, I can't stop it. Like I'm listening to you and I'm hearing both things at the same time, trying to process it. But we'll get back to Matt's question about everything that y'all were doing was really intentional.
We haven't talked. Do you know the connection between David Allen and me?
I think I do. No, I don't actually. Yeah. No, that's a follow-up question I have, but we don't have to get off into that yet, unless that's a good setup for where we are now.
No, just
I know that you work, that you start, that he's involved with Kairos, but I was familiar with him from getting things done first, which I just discovered in the last year. So,
yeah, I came to getting things done as a client in 1999. And I had just gotten a call from security at where I worked that my office had been ransacked. And I burst out laughing because that's how I left it. I was pretty much of a disaster. That my stuff was a mess, and I've had years of psychoanalysis because I'm mad as a hatter. So, you know, between the two.
Okay.
I'm a patient as well as as well as a developer of this stuff. So.
Okay. Then I'd like to speak more about that feel like we're getting a pretty good, I would like to get more technical, to be honest, and we've got the time to do it. But I do want to take care of the story overview part, which is another thing I know that you are very clear on Because the emails that I get from you always start with a simple image, a story that leads in a narrative way, and then begins to give technical information that's very precise. And it's like, oh, that is how you communicate. It's so effective. So I want to make sure in that same way that we understand who you are and your background and how that everybody can place the work that you do. If you can describe it more, and then we can get deeper into it. But how does what you do relate to the, let's say, the Enneagram?
Yeah. And I've looked at all of that stuff too, you know, with, you know, in that, during that period. And most of it has some truth to it. You know, it comes out of people looking at other people and, okay, you know, what makes them tick, and trying to find patterns to that. So the Enneagram came out of that, and I never discourage people from looking at that stuff and seeing if it seeing if it speaks to you. What we've done, as I've said, is we looked at data and analyzed. If I can be street Boston on this, we analyzed the shit out of it.
Yeah, I always make fun of the Enneagram, but that's just kind of for sport. I do understand that people get a lot of good out of it. And one of the reasons they say it's so great is it's timeless, or it's been around for this long, or it's part of this long whatever. And I would just say, okay, but now we've got some pretty intense neuroscience, Mike. We want to use that when we're analyzing how people are. So.
Yeah, and that's where I go.
So. Okay. But, okay, all right.
But yeah,
right, you so know, we're caught up then. That's good.
If the Enneagram is fun for you to do and you get some insight from it, then go for it. Why not? You know.
So. What about the Myers-Briggs and Big Five? Big Five to me seems relatively useful.
Yeah. So the Myers-Briggs, again, something I really admire the development of it. It was developed in the mid-1950s, and it was a very powerful insight into you know, what the different ways we manage and transfer information, you know, and it's interesting you say the Big Five. What the Myers-Briggs did, they mixed the psychological and emotional with the cognitive, because at that point we didn't know enough to know, okay, now we know that our cognitive stuff comes off the top of our brains, the white matter, and our emotional life comes out of the deep midbrain. So in our work at Kairos, we call it Kairos Cognition, because we're looking at how you think about stuff. We're focused in on that and isolated to that. The Big Five is how you feel about stuff. Mm-hmm. And what the Myers-Briggs, up until really the first decade of the 21st century, we didn't know that how to separate how we think about stuff from how we feel about stuff. And so now we do. So now, and I decided to live in the world about how we think about stuff, and the Big Five folks are living in the world of how we feel about it. And I pay attention to both sides, but my expertise, I bring out a push my expertise on how we think about stuff.
That's
David Allen is how we do stuff. So
right.
You go to David Allen for how to actually do the stuff, how to think about it, and Big Five, how to feel about it.
That's the best way I can summarize my life so far, now that you've set it up like that, is if there's three things to do in life, feel things, do things, and think things, I've been stuck in thinking so far for 40 years, only thinking and thinking about thinking, sometimes doing stuff without any hope of being organized, and don't do a lot of feeling either. So that's me. But I understand those frontiers now, and there's tools for me to expand in the other two areas. So that's exactly where you catch me at this point in my life.
Yeah, that's what happens to me as well. My problem is I get stuck in this, it feels like cyclical, where I have to force my attention on something, then I get some form of exhaustion from it or boredom from it or whatever, and then I feel like I've wasted time. And also resentment of myself because I did try, you know, like I'm trying to not waste my time.
Like, yeah. Like you say, like on your site, you're talking about like time definitely is like our most precious, best asset. And it's the number one thing that we don't know how to move through well. Like it is the thing that I have no, like I can understand quickly with my kids or something, if I've treated them poorly or they're treating me poorly or something, like I can understand and tell them, hey, this is what needs to change. But yeah. For me, I cannot overcome myself sometimes.
Yeah, well, you want to look at your score profile?
Sure.
Let's do it.
And maybe we can tell the folks at home, I sound like Norm MacDonald, but this is this is the survey we took, and it was 53 questions. And I don't know, what else do you want to say about it, the actual survey, Francis? Is there anything else you want to say before we get into the results?
What we're doing is we're measuring your reflexive response to the information that's showing up from our surroundings. So we have take in information in all different categories. Well, it turns out we have something analogous to our handedness, in that some of that response to information is easier and more reflexive, and some of that and our response to other information takes more work. And it doesn't mean that it's necessarily better or worse what we're doing, how we're thinking about it, but it's just harder. So same way, I'm right-handed. Just about anything I do with my right hand, I can do with my left. And if I were a professional athlete, I would have trained my left hand to be nearly as competent as my right. But it's always going to be take a little bit more energy, even when you've trained your left, than it will if you're right-handed, than it will be with your right. And then vice versa. If you're, some of us are left dominant, that's going to be reflexively.
And degrees of dominance too.
Yeah, exactly right. May I share my screen?
Yep. Oh, do I have to allow you to share the screen?
And you call these on the site, in my report, it said we call associative and sequential processes. And we also have a separate reflexive responses for our communications processors.
Listener, observer, mover, reader, and talker.
Yep. And we're going to go through those on the report.
Okay. If you're trying to screen share, will it allow you or do I have to do something?
Yeah, let me check here.
I think give it a shot. And if I have to approve it or something, I will.
Yeah, here we go.
Yeah, you got it.
Looks like you got it.
Awesome.
So these are I'm starting with what we call the associative, and there's the two processes that do most of the work of allowing us to manage information, and all of us do both. Much the same way I'm right-handed, I still walk left, right down the street, carry things with both hands. I need to use both, and all of us need to use both. But we do have those degrees of preferences and across a bell curve. And our associative is what we call our rapid integration system. It's what allows us to, what it does is it holds us in the present moment to allow us to be as fully alert in the present so we can be as rapidly responsive to stuff that's coming to us from the present. And really its job is to be alert to opportunities to move toward threats to avoid. It's, so it's constantly assessing the stuff that's coming in, opportunity, grab it, threat, avoid it. Not valuable enough, let it blow past. And, or not a threat enough, let it blow past. And then because of that, it allows us to do something else. So the assessing opportunities and threats are what's happening when you're driving at high speeds down an interstate highway. You're trying to be as present as possible so you can be alert to the brake lights going on in front of you, the car next to you drifting too close, the animal about to bound across the road while the radio's on, the phone starting to ring, and there's a tractor trailer truck roaring up behind you. And the associative gives us that 360-degree present awareness. And then when those red lights come on in front of you, you recognize it as brake lights, take your foot off the accelerator, put it on the brake for exactly the right amount of pressure for the right amount of time to come to a safe stop while checking the rearview mirror to make sure the truck behind you is doing the same thing. And when all of that happens optimally, it's about a 30th of a second. You know, how do we even do that?
Right.
Well, we're accessing our experience, which is to say anything we've learned, remembered, trained for, patterns that we recognize, analogies we can apply, which is why the 30-year-old driver is more effective than the 16-year-old driver, even if the 16-year-old has better eyesight, better hearing, and better reflexes. The 30-year-old driver will, the 16-year-old might notice that thing sooner, but the 30-year-old will recognize it sooner. And then the 30-year-old is more likely to have learned, remembered, and trained responses for how to deal with that thing. So boom, the 16-year-old's, what's that and what do I do now? And the 30-year-old's, boom, done. And on to the next hazard or opportunity.
Oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I never have put it that way. You said recognized it. The older person will recognize it more quickly. That's really interesting, especially like as a sports fan. That's why the older basketball player isn't as prime physical shape, but they recognize what is happening, the associative circle, like you said, more quickly than the person who might physically be quicker. That's cool.
Yeah. So when it goes well, the compensation for getting older is that you've got more stuff to pull from rapidly. So now at some point that starts to
right.
The compensation gives itself out toward the end of our lives. But learned experience helps us for a long way. It gets us a long way down the road.
Right.
So now what's interesting, what else it does is so it's looking for, have I ever seen this? Have I ever experienced this before? Well, if it doesn't find that, have I seen anything like this before to help me understand this? And then if I haven't seen anything like this before, have I seen anything similar or analogous to help me understand this thing that's going on? And then at the very far edge, have I experienced anything that gives me a whisper or a hint or a scent that gives me an idea of what's going on? So it's a little bit like the blood hound. You know, you give it a little bit of a scent and it starts running off toward the target.
Right.
Well, that's exactly what our associative is doing at the far end. If it gets a whisper or a hint or a scent, it takes us in back in to something that we can use.
Do you mind if I interject there?
Yeah.
I don't know if you know this or not, if we covered this when we talked on the phone or not the other day, but Toby and I are musicians, you know, by trade, and podcasters second to that. We've been playing music together and traveling and touring and writing music and creative stuff like that for about 20 years. And what you're saying there is a pretty good description of how, for instance, Toby describes finding creative ideas that you – way out on the edge, and you pull them in and you make them and you find, you know, what it was. I think he just dropped off the call while I was talking about him, or I kicked him off on accident, but he'll reach.
Who knows?
But that is what you're describing there as it applies to, you know, trying to come up with a song, is you have to get so present, and then there's a faintest whisper of an idea, and then you think it's something, and then you make it something, but you have to go way out there to get there to find it. And then try to bring it back. I mean, that kind of feels like what you're describing. Is that?
That's exactly right. And I'm going to get to where you two are on the scale. But I now want to bounce over to the sequential. So the sequential does just the opposite. Its job is to slow us way down, hold us still, so we can put the full weight of our attention and intellectual force on one thing, so that we can understand, how do I know this and how am I going to get this done? So if you're using the associative when you're driving at high speeds down an interstate, you use the sequential that day you walked into an exam room to solve a math problem. Now, you probably walked into that exam room with the associative dialed up so you could take in all of those fascinating people in the room, maybe understand the architecture and design of the room to choose your, you know, optimum seat for you. You were, saw what was going outside, noticed what was going on outside the window, and maybe smelled the aroma of lunch coming from the dining hall that day. All of that's the job of the associative. So now to do solve that math problem, you have to pin your the weight of your attention and focus on that, you know, square inch in front of you, unpack the information in that within that square inch, understand it as a rule of a rule and process, operationalize that rule and process through to a conclusion, and maybe do that 30 or 40 more times. All the while trying not to pay attention to the fascinating people next to you, the person tapping their foot or sneezing or or muttering, and the soccer ball bouncing off the window, and what's going on, you know, and thinking about lunch that day. Does stuff sound familiar?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. I mean, exactly. You describe, and I think our audience has a, you know, Toby and I wind up attracting people that are either in relationship with people like us or are like us in some mirrored way or dependent way. So that type of divergent thinking and hard to wrangle minds is very familiar for all the type of people I roll with.
Yeah, yeah. And so what happens is, you can, if you can see from the curve, almost 60% of the population's over here on the sequential side, mm-hmm. almost 40%'s over here. So because this is most people, the world, education, lots of stuff gets organized around the sequential. Stuff gets thrown at you all the time that people want you to, okay, screen out all of the rich universe of the world around you.
Yeah, exactly.
Focus on this tiny piece and do that for 2 hours, please. Mm-hmm. When you're over here, and you're over on this left hand, that's not how your brain works. And so that was one of the first things that got unpacked with, you know, looking at how kids learn. You know, we were expecting kids who learn over here to learn like kids who learn over here. And it's just wrong. Yeah. So yeah. Go ahead.
I have very detailed thoughts on it. Like I have detailed thoughts of what it feels like to have to shift those two. And I know what it's just the weirdest thing. There's certain things I can do in a sequential way, yeah. Like music editing. Like if I'm editing audio, I get into what I would say is a deep, deep flow state, which I love. And it's extremely far away from being verbal or anything, where I'm just immersed in the, I think I would call that very sequential, but to get my mind into that mode is so far away from this mode that I'm speaking with you today, or, you know, and it feels like I have to go in and focus on the math problem, you know, and there's something satisfying about getting in that mode once you're in it. And if you have the skills to do it, but if you don't even have the skills in that other mode and have to force myself to go into it, you know, it feels like I'm running a different operating system, an emulation of an operating system, basically.
Yeah. And you just described an interesting phenomenon, that ability to get into the flow state doing sequential. The sequential process allows us to keep time. The associative process holds us in the present moment. Mm-hmm. So when you're thinking of the associative process, typically that's the experience you have when you're fully engaged in something. All of a sudden you look up and it's dark, you know, what happened to the time?
Yes, yes.
Because you weren't tracking time. The associative process tracks events. It knows that event A happened before event B, happened before event C, and kind of has the, knows the relative size of that, knows that your recording session was long, your conversation on the phone was short, but it's not really tracking time as distance. This side tracks that tick, tick, tick of time distance as distance. And you probably experienced that in a classroom one day while you were waiting for the period to end, and that mm-hmm. 5 minutes.
Right.
Tick. That's how the sequential keeps time. And so one of the things we see is when we ask people who are sequential preferent, a question like, how long is your daily commute to work? Back when people used to commute to work in the olden days, they'll say things like 29 minutes today and 28 minutes yesterday. And they'll tell you what made the minute difference. And when we ask people who are associative preference, we get answers like about a half an hour. Mm-hmm. And you don't really know if it was 45 minutes or an hour and 15 minutes, but it was a, you know, or 20 minutes or 45 minutes. It was a half an hour size event in your mind. And the only time it's important is when you say, I'll be there in a half an hour to somebody who's sequential preferent. You show up at minute 36. The person who's sequential preferent feels you've just stolen 360 seconds off their lifespan. They'll never get back again. And you're like, what? You know? It's about a half an hour, close enough. But we're walking, these two groups of people are walking through the world. Are walking through the world with a different experience of time. Mm-hmm. And it's completely invisible to us, ourselves, what our experience of time is. And what the other person's experience of time is like.
So what is the audio editing flow state I experience where I am immersed in something I think is sequential, but maybe I'm not even looking at it right. But I'm in a flow state, focused deeply on a small, what I feel like is a small thing, and I definitely lose track of time when doing so.
Yeah, so that's where I'm going. I had to get to the first to go to the second, but yeah, you're absolutely right. You are in the sequential. So here's what's happened. The reason we know about this time stuff is a neuroscientist, David Eagleman. You want to look him up.
Okay, I've heard his name.
Yeah. So yeah, he's done the breakthrough work on time. And there are great videos out there where he's getting people to bungee jump with an instrumentation, you know, to get them into the associative to see to track the experience of time moving slow.
Is this the one where if you're scared, time moves like, do you record more while you're falling backwards off of a thing? Yeah, I know that experiment. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, one of the things he's got is we keep time with our sequential, and our sequential is headquartered in our frontal lobes right behind the tops of our foreheads. And our brain's timekeeping mechanism is a set of neurons right there behind the tops of our foreheads that pulse on a regular basis the way a quartz crystal does in a digital clock. And those pulses, and as a musician, it's a syncopated pulse of those neurons, is how our brain uses to track time. Now, the thing is that keeping time is costly to our brains. It takes a lot of energy to do that, and it slows our brain down. That's why we keep time with our sequential and not our associative. If our associative kept time, our associative would be too slow and we'd never be able to drive down interstate highways because we couldn't make that rapid response. We can only make that rapid response if we unhook from our time keeping mechanism. And nearly all of us unhook from that time, unhook from the timekeeping mechanism when we go into the associative and hook back in when we go into the sequential. There's a rare number of individuals, typically people who are way over on the associative side, sound familiar? and people typically with a high degree of cognitive energy who are able to do sequential processing unhooked from the clock. And so when you're doing that deep dive in that intense focus and you're losing track of time at the same time, you're one of those rare people who can do sequential thinking but unhook yourself from that.
Yeah, I've described it as being in another place. It's not, I'm not sitting here at this desk. I'm in the computer. I'm surfing the waveforms. I'm one with the machine at that time. And if my daughter walks in the room to ask me a question, it feels like she's standing right beside me and talks to me. It feels like she's 70 miles away and I have to walk down a long hallway before I can say, yeah, okay, you can watch the TV.
No, like, you're exactly right.
So far. And then I had to go back down the hall. And now I'm so far away from being able to re-engage what I was doing.
No, you're in an altered state of consciousness. It's a real thing. It's a real neurological place. It's nothing, you know, well, mysterious to someone like David Eagleman, it's not mysterious to, but but it's, you know, you're still inside that brain, but you're in, you're using that sequential processor without its clock. And that just makes the sequential process do something different that it doesn't do when it's connected to its clock. And it does something that the associative process doesn't do.
Well, yeah, thank you for giving me some language for that.
I might have to get you to explain that to my wife, because she, when I do the same thing, she's like, did you not hear anything I said or whatever? But I'm thinking about something, and I'm, like Matt said, I'm just there. Like, especially when I'm being creative or like writing music or something, I'm not in the room. I might even be with the listener. What I think, like, I go to them and what they are responding to. Like, I'm, that's just how my brain works. But I'm just thinking, what will this make someone feel, and how will they understand it and grasp what I'm saying, and what will it make them do? Bob their head or enjoy it or feel something very emotional? And I'm there. And then you're right. My wife wants me to empty the dishwasher. And she's right. Yeah. And she's not being mean, but how do I get there? It almost seems like I'm being a jerk.
You can't even process the request when she makes
it. No, you're in a deep brain space where your input outputs are shut off, and you're just inside the chip. You know? So the speakers are off, the microphone's off, the camera's off. And you're deep inside. So tell the people you live with, you're not, I can vouch that you're not ignoring them. Probably are times when you do ignore them, but that's a different state. You know? This state is, you're very deep in there, and there's enough input output. And, you know, if the building went on fire, you know, it would alert you. But other than that, it's in a very deep state, you know, closed off from the inputs, outputs.
Yeah, I can remember when I was little, people used to use the term, and it might be true or appropriate, but selective listener. That's what they would say. You know, I was a selective listener.
For lazy or bad kids.
Right. That's what it always meant. But I was like, I'm like you were saying with the story earlier, the kid could definitely read. He just had to figure out how to get to what he could read. And that's the way I've always kind of felt. Like I have lots of stuff that I can, do, but I get caught up in my world or something, and it's hard for me to go back out of it.
Your heart.
I know.
Right. Well, you know, and in fact, both of you are active listeners over here, but this isn't how well you hear. You know, it doesn't have anything to do with your hearing. It's the kind of sound your brain responds to. And out here, your brain is looking for new sound, nuanced sound, meaningful, subtle sound, stuff that, you know, that's, you know, more than just ordinary conversation the ordinary, you know, sound of the stuff and, you know, necessary stuff out there.
Toby, let me give you that one, how it works in our world. When we're on our tour bus hanging out, oftentimes somebody will be there that you have to entertain or make small talk with as a guest. And if I'm caught with that person, I'm miserable, of course. Toby and Dave will be on the other side of the bus having a conversation very far away, and they'll say something, and I'm looking at them, and Toby looks at me, and he looks at Dave, and he says, "What, Toby, about me?" You tell Dave, he's always listening.
Yeah, he's always listening.
Because
I'm
listening to what they're saying, and this person's sitting here. I'm trying to pretend like I'm talking to them, but I'm scanning for what's the most important thing in the room, and it isn't what I'm doing, and it drives me crazy.
Right. Your brain is scanning for interesting, valuable, and useful information. And it's not the loudest. It's not the closest.
It's not the person I'm making eye contact with.
Not the person you're making eye contact with. Might be. It's great when that coincides. Yeah. But your brain, and your brain's making its own decision about what it thinks is interesting, valuable, and useful sometimes. You're not even fully in control of that.
It's gotten me into trouble. So this is the thing. Y'all talking now is helping me understand a little bit of me. So I realized that those things that I noticed I was just noticing them, not putting any judgment on them. Yeah. But I realized if I used that in conversation or brought that topic up, it made other people laugh. For example, Matt, like Matt, one of the things I noticed about him that I think other people might notice but don't think about it as much as me would be he'll eat and the way he when he's a talker, so he'll talk while he's eating, but he breathes through his nose, and then he's doing like and I'm just noticing it, and I can't not think about it. And then I realize, oh, if I bring this up, everybody will laugh, and Toby's funny. But Matt might, you know, or somebody might think I'm being a bully or I'm being mean. And I'm just saying it because it does get a laugh. Everybody else then recognizes the thing that it's kind of, I guess that's probably a part of observational comedy, I guess, or something. You know, that you observe something that everybody kind of knows, but they're not picking up on the level that you have. And then you bring it to their attention, and they go, oh, that's really funny. But that's kind of how my brain works. I pick up things of people, and it with probably no judgment, really, you know, but it's just something that I can hear in my head right now. I know exactly what it sounds like for Matt to be eating something and trying to talk to me.
and to your brain, it's just data. And then, you know, but then when you bring it out of your brain out into the world, you know, then.
Right.
And of course, observational comedy is, you know, always is based a little bit on surprise. And you know, people who aren't fully conscious of this stuff, it's still going into their brains. You know, it's get, you know, their brains are picking up, but their brains are just kind of batting it off because they're not making it. So when you bring it forward, it's like, oh my gosh. And that's that shock of recognition and surprise that can be there. Or if you're the target of it, it can be embarrassing and shame. So yeah, but it's really, it's just data. You know, it's just your brain's taking in data. And then that's the big five that tells us how we're going to, how it's going to impact us emotionally.
Mm-hmm. And so Toby and I are trying to get a grip on this when we think about ourselves a little bit, but the big five then is your temperament, basically. And that seems to be set like a thermostat with neurotransmitter configurations to keep you on track at your temperament, is my understanding of that. Does that jive with what we're talking about here? Toby has a need for that type of thinking and that type of reward for observing that or finding the interesting nugget. Like there's something in something in there that's driving us to do that.
Yeah, and so much of our emotional response is learned behavior. The cognitive stuff. I also have associative preference. So I'm going to be associative preferent no matter what room I walk into, no matter what person is in front of me, but I might be, I'm more extroverted in some circumstances with some people and more introverted with others. Mm-hmm. So the emotional stuff is more context specific, and it's responses that get developed from our social interactions. And what's so fascinating is that infants are watching how their parents respond to people. So who do they treat like authority figures? Who do they treat like peers? Who do they seem to warm up when someone walks into the room? Who do they get cold or fearful when somebody walks in the room? And infants are picking all that stuff up. And that's what starts to go to drive our emotional responses.
So some of your temperaments in the big five are genetic, and some of them are set in that early childhood based on that. And then the different environments, you'll respond different ways to re-regulate to your baseline temperament.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. And some things you can change, but like right-handed, left-handed, you can get better at left-handed if you're right-handed. You can get better at right-handed if you're left-handed, but we don't switch.
Excellent. All right. So that on listener, Toby and I are on more of the active listener, scanning for stuff. And some people, the opposite of that is what?
So the selective listener is when your auditory process really goes into sleep mode, unless it's really interesting, really valuable, or really useful. And it's looking for big stuff. It's not picking up subtleties. It's not, now you can point it out to somebody. So my brother-in-law is an audio engineer, and he picks up on stuff that I don't pick up on, but he can put headphones on me and say, now listen for this thing. And when he tells me, then I'll hear it. Mm-hmm. But I'm not automatically picking up the nuance.
Right. That's a person who just listens to a song and hears the song and it sounds good to them.
Right. Exactly.
They're hearing the bass drum frequencies specific to the bass guitar.
It's main idea thinking. Exactly. And main idea pickup, where you two are picking up the nuances. Mm-hmm.
What's the next category after listener?
We have observer.
Yeah, observer next, yeah. Oh, so is observer the set similar to listening but visual?
Yeah, so yeah, it's parallel. So there we go. I'm having trouble with my finger here, control here. All right, let's go. Come on. Why isn't it doing that for me?
It's okay.
There we go. Now, this is where the two of you have a split. And observer, you probably never noticed, listener is a single bell curve with the most of the population in the center. Observer is another double bell curve. And what we get is on this side, on the left side, we call that So listener is your responsiveness to meaningful sound. This is your responsiveness to meaningful visual information. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out visual information comes to us as humans in two kind of packages. One is our responsiveness to essential information. We're looking for how well does this thing do the thing it's supposed to do? Is it functional? Is it useful? Is it well-designed? So a tool, how does it fit in your hand? How is it balanced? What is the, how easy it is to use that tool to do the thing the tool was designed for? You're really looking for that useful, efficient quality of design. And then when we're on this symbolic side, we're looking for the stories things tell. So the symbolic information begins with our facial expressions, our body language, our style and fashion, the way we organize and decorate our spaces, to all the language of art and architecture and design. And one of the ways we represent the difference is to take, say a mug for a hot beverage. You know, the mug has, this is a designed for essential quality. It has a size, it has a volume, it has an insulating capacity, as the way the handle responds to my hand and the rim to my lip, all of which allows it to do its functionally useful job of conveying a hot beverage. Now, that same mug could have symbolic quality, and that it had your logo on it, your Bad Christian logo on it, or it could have been made by a potter, or it could have been a gift, a souvenir, or even a family heirloom, in which case it has a story attached to it. And that story doesn't allow it to do its functionally useful job any better. But we create identities around those stories. We convey information about ourselves around those stories. And those stories often will hold memories or associations for us. So even though they don't allow us to do the thing better or may improve the quality, the essential quality of that thing, those stories are very important to us. Does that make sense to you hearing that? That the two
oh, man, that's the most essential split between Toby and I that give us a complementarianism that really works, because we're aligned on a lot of the things, but this is the one where it's just completely different, you know. I can't even recognize people's faces, and I can't tell if my wife gets a haircut, except for when she tells me, I knew it. I saw it. I knew you got a haircut. I swear I knew it.
Right. If it gets pointed out to you.
I knew it. I knew. I just didn't see it yet. I mean, I saw it, but I didn't say it to my brain where I can say it with words yet. I don't, you know, and Toby will never not notice something if somebody's shoe was funny.
Right. I'm the person that always see if we're at an airport, I find the celebrity that's walking through before anybody could ever or would even notice it. I know I always do that. It's funny, at the end of mine, this section, it says, if you buy something, it must look good. And that, so it's funny, you're right, we compliment each other, Matt and I. I've always been jealous in a sense of Matt's observer level here, because he can just move on. And I can't. Like, we've built a bunch of stuff, like in our bus, or we go to Home Depot, and Matt will just pick out the wood, the 2x4, throw it on the cart, and we're moving along. And I'm like, wait, but don't you see that that piece of wood doesn't look as good as this other one over here? And that one might not be as good as this. If we dig a little bit deeper, we might even find the better one. And so I'm stuck there thinking. They always make fun of me at the food court in the mall. I have to go to every single restaurant and see which one looks the best, is going to be the best, so I can get it.
It has to have a story and a meaning for him. Matt can move right.
Yeah, it has to have a story and a meaning.
He got the best deal at the food court. He has to weave it into a story where he's a hero that and now he's eating the $6 lunch.
But 30 minutes after everybody else. It takes so long, but you're right. Yeah, that is. I'm very much like that. Yeah,
I'm hyper functional. You know, like I use one cup all day, every day, except for when I drink tea, and I drink it out of the half gallon jug that it comes in because it's very functional. But I do have, to the point that you can switch. I have a Bad Christian glass that has our logo on it, and I choose that many times. It's the only other cup I would ever use, and it's deeply meaningful when I choose it. But otherwise, I just need the liquid inside of me.
Yep. And we all do both. Again, it's like, you know, walking left, right down the street. But yeah, we lean one way or the other. And so, yeah, when that 2x4 is in the wall, is it really better?
Right.
Yeah. It's probably going to hold the house up just about as long.
Oh, exactly.
And it's also the exact divide between Toby and I, where I'm designing the user experience and hierarchy of a website, which is just the most important thing in the world to me. If it's wrong, I can't survive the day. But I don't know anything about what it should look like. And people go, but you seem like you have all these opinions. But I feel like I'm like a blind person explaining something that's very important visually. Yeah. Like I feel like I'm blind. I'm not looking at things ever. I'm just thinking about them and telling you about them. I'm not looking at stuff unless it's an emergency.
But you're creating that essential user experience.
Yes.
So the user's eye goes to the right place. Their fingers go to the right place. Yeah.
Will they be confused here or not? You know, is it right? That has to go first because it's more important, stuff like that. But I don't know what it should look like or what colors to use. I don't care.
Now, I'll give you an example of the extreme end of the essential. Worked with a woman who is 5 on the essential scale. She's an anesthesiologist, and she's the one they call when they have a 14 or 16 hour surgery, because operating rooms are messy, noisy. You know, 16 hour surgery, they're arguing with each other. It's amazing they even function. You know, for that 16 hour surgery, she just has her total focus on the patient.
Laser beam. Yeah.
Wow. She probably couldn't tell you the names of the other people in the room. You know, she's worked with them for years because they're not interesting data. Who the surgeon was wasn't interesting. it's all in the patient. And so that 5 observer means she's distracted by nothing. And so she can do that very difficult, sensitive, important job to keep somebody alive over, you know, in an anesthesia for 14, 16 hours while they're taking the person apart and putting them back together again.
I mean, that doesn't make me feel good about ever going under anesthesia, that you need that to keep you alive. If they get distracted, you die. Okay.
Yeah. You want the person who's not distracted, doesn't care what, what color, cap the doctor's wearing. Right. Exactly right.
All right. We got three more here. What is it? We got mover, reader, and talker.
Yes, I'm going to go back. So I didn't get to put all yours on the bell curve. So I'm going to go back out and bring your reports up. Do you remember what yours
are?
We're
both, obviously, anybody out there can guess what we show up on talker.
Yeah.
Well, talker,
I'm 89% on talker.
And I'm 93 on that.
Okay. Yeah. So mover, reader, and talker do the same thing, but do it differently. What they do is they represent the neurostimulus we activate when we activate one of these. So mover is the first one we learned about when marathon runners started talking about a runner's high. So what's this? When they, mile 22, when they should be in absolute exhaustion, they're getting euphoric. How is that possible? Well, it turns out when we activate our striated muscles, the muscles that move our skeleton, we actually self-generate a stimulus. And that stimulus does several important things. It calms us a little bit, sharpens our focus a little bit, improves our memory and retrieval a little bit, elevates our mood a little bit. And the higher you are up in the talker scale, the more powerful that neurostimulus shows up, with simple physical activity. And so it wakes up your whole brain. So you're hearing that. Is that right?
So that just means, a lot of this, I guess, is really close to, I think, evolutionary psych at this point, right? Because it's just like, how would you be selected for an environment? But if you got to do some serious shit, then it's going to give you the chemicals required to do it, basically.
Yeah.
Like if you start running or getting an ice bath or whatever, it's like, here we go. And now you feel euphoric and it's time to get active because you obviously need to survive right now. That helps you then think, because now you're moving, now you have that chemical, now you're alert, now you feel good, now you're focused on survival, and now you can write a paragraph.
A lot of us still have fingers and toes, because that sharpening of our attention when we're in motion kept us a little bit more alert when we were using the saw, it is adaptive. Now, at the same time, someone who's 25 on the mover scale, I call those people the iron seat people. Those are the people who can sit still and stay focused for long periods of time without feeling any urge to move, because they don't get any neurostimulus from it. Mm-hmm. So, we say strengths and weaknesses come out of the same well. What makes it easier for us to do one thing makes it harder for us to do others. Mm-hmm. The three of us are all active movers. Mm-hmm. So my physical activity is swimming. I'm lucky enough to live near a facility where I can swim laps every morning. And that sets my whole day up. If I go in, swim laps, calms me, focuses me, wakes up my brain, I'm ready, I'm alert. And it improves my mood too. Mm-hmm. So if I'm anxious, that's going to pull my anxiety down. If I've got a stressful day coming up, it'll set me up. Does all that sound familiar?
Well, I do. I go underwater every morning outside in the cold.
Oh, great. Yes.
For the same reason. And if I had a lap pool, I would definitely go ahead and knock out 45 minutes of strenuous at that time. Maybe not in the cold water, but that what you described there is right on for me.
It's funny. I feel like doing some exercise, especially like walking, running for me, maybe even swimming too, if I had that. I don't have a facility near me, but I feel like it makes everything about my attention go down to that, so that then I can have free thought.
And like, I think when I'm bored, if you will, or I lose my attention, it's because I'm doing some kind of low level thing, like looking at Instagram or something, something that just takes my attention. So if I'm out jogging, my attention, there's enough of my attention focused on keep moving. I know it's hard, but you know, are you breathing right? You go a little bit further, that then the creative side of me can just open up and I can think about my day more clearly. I can think about the work that I have to do, all of that stuff. And you're right. And then afterwards, I'm have spent some energy so that I can feel like I'm more focused.
Yeah. And are you picking up the pattern that you're, that none of these are at the center of the bell curve for any, for you?
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, second, it's all ties in this way. That's just crazy because the second I understood what alternative music was or saw Kurt Cobain, I'm like, oh, I know. I've always known I'm not regular. I just, this has been so obvious to me that I'm not like, you know, the humans or, that I grew up around or the standard ones and I didn't fit in or whatever. So just alternative culture has always been a call. Anything that's, you know, anything I care about, I won't have the mainstream view on it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just that the middles of bell curves are not for me.
Yeah.
Any way you want to measure it, I'm not surprised to find that out.
Yeah. And, you know, we need people at the ends of the bell curve out there finding the stuff to drag back into the center. for everybody else. But it's tough to be 10 years ahead of everybody, or sometimes a whole generation or two ahead of everybody.
Well, you don't, it's not necessarily ahead unless it's just something that people, you know, I think the interest thing is like, you could be interested in something that's not useful to anybody and never will be,
sure. Yeah.
You know, it's not ahead, you know, but sometimes, sure enough, I was ahead of many people in many things, but sometimes it's just, I'm interested in something that never mattered. To anybody,
right? And yeah, why be normal? You know, that's just different stuff activates your brain. That's cool. Why not? So reader is that same neurostimulus, but this time generated by decoding text. So when we decode text, our eyes literally have to search and find the letter or word, identify the letter as a word as a symbol, identify the symbol as a sound. It's a three-step neurological process.
Say those again. I'm sorry. I have real trouble in this area, so I'm curious.
Sure. So you have to identify, so you have to search and find the letter or the word. So you're looking at the page, you got to find, you know, your starting point. You've got to see the first letter. You've got to hold on to that first word.
I hate that part.
Yeah. And then and then to identify that. So you're identifying that, you're searching and finding that symbol. And then you need to, identify it as meaning something. So those marks on the page, you know, there's a lot of marks on the page, on pages. These are marks on page that have that represent a symbol. So you've got to then identify what the symbol is. Mm-hmm. And then you've got to identify the symbol as a sound. And we can also get the possibility of a neurostimulus for this. Let me check both of you here. Let me get back down.
That's already interesting because I don't know if I do the sound part with words. If I have to read out loud, then I have to turn them into sounds, but then I can't retain the information. But if I get a text, I scan it and I understand it, but I never read it left to right. I just, the important words stick out, the context matters, and I think I know what they were saying, but I don't really read if I'm trying to. If you want me to really know what's on a page, reading it left to right isn't the way I attain the information. That's the way I say it to other people, but then I don't get to know what it said if I read it out loud.
Right, right. So you want to, look, I'll send you a link to it. Professor of Literature at the University of Paris wrote a book called How to Talk About Books You Haven't Read. And he actually, he's a leading professor of literature in Paris. He thinks reading is overrated. What you're trying to do is get information.
Right.
And however you get that information is you get the information. And if you talk about it with somebody, get it from YouTube, you know, doesn't matter. And he's scandalize the academic world. What? You don't read?
Right.
Well, you know, he says when you read from the first word to second word, the third word to the last word, nobody closes the book and then recites the book from first word, second word, third word, last word. You've lost most of it. You've forgotten it. He calls it unreading. And so you've put all of that attention and energy and time into it, only to inevitably forget most of it. He says, so don't bother do that in the first place.
Love it. I just kind of stare at the middle of the page and move around until I understand what the page means. That's what I do.
Pierre Bayard would applaud you for that.
So sometimes I can absorb a page in seconds, and you know what I mean, from a few clues, like a Jeopardy clue. Yep. Like in Jeopardy, I'm good at Jeopardy because I see all the words at once and answer the question with the while I'm listening to the beginning of the question. Before anybody else knows the question, I've already seen the key words and I know what the question is probably going to be. And I think that's how people get good at Jeopardy. You know, it's a double process of taking in the data from the question more than listening to Alex read it or reading it ahead yourself.
Right. You're doing both. Which is really hard too when you think about how tests in elementary school, you know, middle school, high school because I'm retaining some of the information, but I can't tell you the answer to the question that clearly or detailed, right? Like before we got on here, Francis, I was telling Matt, because we were talking about our test here, our survey, and I read a book recently that was super impactful to me. Mm-hmm. And it was about how, life has meaning under all circumstances. And I said, Matt, I do not remember the author of the book or what the name of the book is. And he said, Matt hasn't read the book. He says, you mean Viktor Frankl, right? And I've talked to Matt about this book a lot, but I can remember. But
I know it well.
Right. But Matt understood it from me telling him about it. And right. I understood the big themes of the book and what it was trying to tell me and about logos therapy and what Viktor Frankl was trying to say, but I did not value his name. His name didn't have much of a value to me because I cared about the information, not telling people, hey, I read this book by Viktor Frankl. That feels, who cares about that, you know?
It'll come up on Jeopardy, though, and I'll get it.
Right, but I read the book and was highly impacted by it and would lose that question on Jeopardy.
Yeah,
and I'll look like the one that knows the book that hadn't read it.
Right,
yeah, I know. No, that's me.
Well, different stuff gets our attention. My reader score is 23, by the way, not to be competitive here. Or anything. So my life's work has been trying to keep people on the ends of the bell curve from being oppressed. I'm fighting for people at the ends of the bell curve.
That's such a good way to say it. I didn't know you thought that. Awesome. So is that a understood? Spend some more time there. Is that a formal way that you think of all your work? And when did you know that?
Yeah. I knew it when I was 7 years old. My cousin who lived across the street, you know, was struggling to ride a bike, and he was getting teased, and my uncle, his father, was frustrated with him all the time, like, what's wrong with you? Everybody can ride a bike at your age. And I could see that whenever he was, you know, we lived in this dense urban neighborhood, and so there are always people out in the street. So whenever someone's, if you're taking a kid out to learn how to ride a bike, you attract a crowd. Just what happened? And and I could tell he was distracted by all the people. So one Saturday morning, we both happened to be out early. There was no one out in the street. I said, can I help you ride a bike? And we were 9 months apart. We were super competitive. He really needed to ride a bike if he would let me help him. That's how bad he needed to. I got him started, got him going. Also realized that the way the sun was hitting made a difference. He needed to be riding into the sun, so that he didn't get distracted, by the shadow in front of him. he just had that high level of visual awareness. It was just distracting him. I couldn't have said it that way then, but I could, but I understood it. And he learned how to ride a bike that morning and, you know, never stopped.
How'd that feel to you? You realized that you had a special ability at that time?
No, I just, I felt weird all the time. So it was just another, you know, weird nerd thing that, you know, it was, that I had. And it happened to be, it happened to put me in affiliation with my cousin instead of conflict with my cousin. So, but it was a risk. It could have gone either way. Yeah, he could have told me to fuck off and then we'd be in a fight. So,
right.
But he didn't, so it worked. But that story I told you about the kid who was, you know, who was struggling to read. Put me into, for a long time, I was a teacher, then a school administrator, and I was trying to make schools work for those kids. Then I went to work at a college, and that's what got me to Vermont. It's called Landmark College. It was actually started by a Harvard PhD who had a third grade reading level. And he started first in elementary and then high school for kids with learning, who had what we call learning disabilities. And then he started a college for college students with learning disabilities, which is still here. It's and still thriving. And my job was to make college possible for people at the ends of the bell curve. And that's when we developed this survey out of that. How do we recognize how we teach people? So how do we bring these students in, do a rapid assessment? Because none of the other tools, SATs weren't predictive, lots of diagnostic testing weren't predictive, IQ tests weren't predictive, school records weren't predictive. I once accepted a student without recommendations because he told me, if you need recommendations, I can't go here because none of my teachers like me. Okay, right. I'm going to accept you. because I know what you're up against.
So right. Do you use the word oppressed versus the word something like underserved?
I think that they're being served, you know, there's whole departments of special ed and of people trying to serve. There are outlier educators who are recognizing these students and doing great work with them. But the system is not working. Am I wrong? You're up there.
No, you're not wrong.
not wrong at all.
Yeah.
The intent, the word oppressed is a strong word, and it's very hard.
Heartbroken. I am heartbroken by what's going on out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And why isn't there more movement then? Like, it seems like almost everybody can articulate what we're saying generally here, that it's this part of the system is broken along with many other parts for many reasons. But why is it this way?
What
forces prevent progress from your view?
Here's the example of what it should have worked and it didn't. So, Cory Booker, now U.S. Senator, was mayor of Newark, New Jersey. He got together with Chris Christie, who was then governor of New Jersey. Booker's a Democrat, Christie's a Republican. They got together around education and they brought in Mark Zuckerberg, and they were going to put all of their focus in on the Newark public schools. So with a combination like that, They should have created something that this is what now 10 or 15 years ago. They should have created something that was transformative, and now the whole country would have. Total failure. The bureaucracy, it was like shooting arrows into a 50-story marshmallow. You know, nothing happened. Three talented, coming at it from different perspectives, coming at it with different resources, fully committed to do this thing, and they couldn't make it happen. There's just too much at stake keeping things the way they are.
I think that there's a guy named Ray Dalio who's been frustrated by many initiatives to do things, but for the same reason. Are you familiar with him?
Yeah. In fact, I read something he said this weekend that made me think I wanted to call him up. You know, he doesn't have more money than Mark Zuckerberg does.
Right.
So I don't know. He's right. Yeah, I read what he said, and he's absolutely right.
Mark Zuckerberg and Dalio both probably really understand this stuff, is my sense, that they're alternatively wired people, neurodivergent individuals probably themselves, and see things clearly and have billions of dollars. And and it's not like they wouldn't try if they could. So is that's just the way it is?
Well, I don't know. If you could just do it with money, Michael Bloomberg would be president right now.
Mm-hmm.
He had all the tech savvy and all the money. And when he ran for president, that's not enough. You got to win the war of ideas.
And, so you think it'll be something? Do you think there is? Do you think anything like what will it take for change to happen? Do you think in the system it'll be a long, long time thing, or is it? It's worth. I guess what I'm asking is, it's worth just digging in and helping individuals then, or is it like trying to? Is it a waste of time to look forward to a newer thing altogether?
Well, when Jim Kim was head of the World Bank 5 or 6 years ago, he said his goal was to end poverty for the 2.5 billion people who lived under $2 in the world who live under $2 a day. And it's important that people have that focus, but most of us, got to feed the people around us. That's our job, is to make sure the people around us get fed, and the people in our communities get fed, and eventually maybe that'll get to the 2 billion people who aren't, and maybe we can do things that will get to a few of them. But it's a big thing. And no, you're really hitting on. I've been working on this school thing since the early 80s. So it's coming up on 40 years, and I feel as though when I was first doing this work, we really believed we were going to transform education, and mm-hmm. we were going to open it up to and almost 40 years, it hasn't happened. And I feel personally responsible for it.
Oh my gosh.
But I don't know. But you're asking me what to do, and I don't know.
I see. Well, I'm glad to hear it bounce off of you there that way. So thank you.
It feels like there's just so many factors that go into it. Like even your story about teaching, I think it was your cousin, to ride a bike. Mm-hmm. The idea there is, he needed someone outside of his family to give him the space and the process to do it. And I was just thinking, when you were telling that story, I was like, well, his dad, maybe his dad yelled at him about not riding his bike fast. He's like, I'm not going, he felt that emotion of it. And so, son, I know there are certain things with my kids that I yell at them for, because I think my dad or mom yelled at me for it. And I don't want them to
feel like I just said, just learn it quickly, or it, and it's easier just to keep everything in the center. You know what I mean? Not on the edge of the bell curve. If you know, if you can keep everybody filling in there, once you start giving people some space to go, wait, I learned this way, I do this, yep, I would like, then you do have to accommodate for them, and everybody's like, ah, I'm busy, it's hard, I don't want to do that. But the truth is, if we could get there, then it would be more fulfilling and things would move more quickly. But it's just, it's weird that, like you were saying earlier, as you get older, you become more aware and can see the situation more clearly than maybe a younger person. But it's still hard with all the factors that have gone into your life. All the factors of my life, I know how I want to, like, my kids to learn or teach them. But in the moment, sometimes I just want to get it done. Well, just get the project done. We'll help you. You know, like my son right now is making a model for his class. He's in third grade, about the gold rush. And he says, you know what I want? I want a big cave. And my wife is like, no, we're going to do this, this, and this. And he's like, yeah, okay. you know, and part of me is like, well, but we had to get the project done, because getting the project done is the goal of the teacher.
Right.
More than even really remembering and learning about the gold rush. You know what I mean? The teacher.
So tell me what he wanted to do, because if I had been a third grade teacher, I probably would have wanted him to do it.
Yeah, I know. He thought, man, I want a big cave. Like, he didn't even care about the like panhandling the river and everything. He was thinking, you go, because he thinks a cave is cool. You want to go in the cave and then you can, you know, pickaxe out some gold maybe like that, which is really cool. But what he's not thinking, we're older, is like, well, how are you going to show people inside the cave? But he thinks, you know, so we go, well, let's just do the river and we'll do this and it'll look really good. And it's going to look good. But the goal for now, I realized very quickly that the teacher and us, the parents, realized, oh, just get the project done and we'll move on.
Don't innovate in the area of cave illumination.
Right. Because that would take forever. Right. Which is really crappy, because that would be actually learning. If he did that, he would realize, well, he would learn about cave illumination, or how do you let somebody see inside a cave? How could you make that the thing that would actually stick with him and build a foundation? And so I think I
would go one step farther in my mind, and I'm sorry if I'm crazy, but I do think that it would be people just like him at his exact age that actually might be responsible for innovation, not actually learning themselves. To one day, I think that that mind in that state at that age, if harnessed properly, probably unlocks things for adults that they're not capable of unlocking. I believe that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's just like Francis's story. He was able to show his cousin, the bike riding, you're focusing on trying to do the bike riding thing, whereas it's bigger here. Look at, you need to ride towards the sun, your shadow, all this stuff. Like, you were able to intuitively see some of that stuff that he wasn't able to see, and then he was riding his bike that day. So you were able to meet the goal that his dad wanted to, but his dad just wanted the thing to be done, as opposed to how do you do it? And then that he probably, you know, on some level realized, you know, how he could transfer that into other aspects of his life as well.
Can we use the remaining time to speak a little bit about getting things done? Because, you know, I'm dying to know about that. And that's a separate conversation on its own, too. But the part of this has left people like Toby and I hopelessly disorganized, I accept it as permanent, you know, like I'll have limits, you know, because I can't do this or that or whatever. I just accepted that at some point when other people were becoming organized, and it was just no chance I could do it. There's no chance I could do it like they did it, or it just was so far off that I just thought it was an impossible task. I just have to be limited by it. And, I've been forced into situations where my bandwidth is totally limited. I've got kids and all this stuff and went through a particularly difficult year last year without having any ability to know how to really navigate it, management. And I just happened to encounter getting things done, and something about it sounded interesting. Although I reject all productivity, this or that stuff when it's out there, I just reject it because I know it doesn't work for me. But something about this sounded different, and I started paying attention to it, and it just, the nature of the language and the way it's explained is so understated that it kept pulling me in instead of promising me things. It would just say common sense stuff. And the main thing in it there is he talks about a mind like water, you know, and I started to get the sense that he's talking about extremely deep horizon things, but he's just talking about a calendar to most people. But to me, he was speaking to the deepest parts of who I am. And now I'm not like, I understand that I could do this calendar stuff and this stuff as a discipline, but it will reorganize my mind. I know that that's possible. I could see it because I could see a pathway all of a sudden and how it actually worked and the system works within itself in a logical framework or whatever. It was clear that it was developed by somebody similar to me. And so I just kind of got in there, and it's been 100% life changing. Like, I still haven't mastered it, but I haven't given up. I haven't lost a thing in my inbox in over a year. I may not have done it all, but I have it. And I know that there's a way to get it done, you know? And it's just, there's something about that system that is, I don't know. It seems like it's for people like me, I guess. I don't know if it is or if it has a deeper meaning, but it stays out of the self-help in a way that's, it's hard for me to get the language for. I'm curious how you found it or how you would articulate what I'm trying to say there clunkily.
Yeah, no, David, and I'll introduce you to him, and I would not be at all surprised if he would do a podcast with you. He's a super open guy, and
thank you.
And I'll encourage him to do that. David, actually, did this work. He has a deep spirituality, considered and non-Western. You can go into it's called MSIA is the spiritual movement. You can look it up. David got there from being probably there's a Wikipedia page where it outlines he was doing bad everything for a while, so he will identify with the bad Christian, in his spiritual awareness, he realized he needed to clean the clutter out of his life. We're given this life, what's really important with it? And what he recognized in his own life is his life was just full of clutter and full of doing stuff that had no meaning. And Mind Like Water is to get at a state where you don't have clutter so that you're fully present in this life. David is, and it allows me to share this, David is active associative. To be fully present in this life and be fully present with the people you're engaged with. And getting things done was a way of clearing the clutter, making space to be present at every moment. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. What you do is, what clutters us is you make a commitment and then aren't keeping it. And that creates self-conflict. An open loop. And creates self-conflict and conflict with others. So you want to understand when you're on the phone with somebody, they want something from you. Okay, I'll get you that tomorrow, Friday, next afternoon. You've just made a commitment. You've made an open loop. Do you have any way of, do you know how you're going to keep that commitment?
Yeah. And we just tend to keep it in our RAM. Like I'll remember to do it, and you may or may not, but the keeping up with it itself is the tax.
Yeah. Right. Because then now you're taking up space, thinking about that thing you're going to do in the future. And so you're not available in the present.
Correct.
Or you're less available in the present. So it's really ultimately about simplifying your life, making as few commitments as possible. And then understanding that when you make a commitment, that commitment is often a multi-step thing, which David calls a project. Anything that takes more than, hand me that glass, that's a single action. make some tea. That's a project. Get groceries in the house for the week. That's a bigger project. Earn a living to feed a family. Bigger project.
Right.
But all of that stuff comes down to a thing you do in every moment. Mm-hmm. And so you do one thing in the moment, one thing at a time. And part of the big part of it is just being aware of that and then realizing what your mortal limits are every day. So we, you know, we want to make all of these commitments so that we can feel good about ourselves or have other people think we're amazing. But if we're making commitments and then not following through, it diminishes us and takes up space and in our heads and takes up territory in our lives. And, you know,
Yeah, I never had a clue that you could do things that weren't emergencies. I never knew that. I just had resigned to, well, I'll say yes to everything and I'll solve every emergency with hustle and finesse, and I do. And that is great, except for, you know, if I'm really looking back at it now, the amount of things I didn't complete, people I've let down, open loops I've had and had to become numb to deal with it is larger than I thought, it turns out, you know.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean, you know, David Smith at all, it doesn't mean you can't be really busy, you know, if that's mm-hmm. satisfying to you. You know, you can run, high energy all day long. You're just closing your loops as you go. Mm-hmm.
Well, it makes me not take commitments that I shouldn't take. You know, as a personal weakness of mine is to take ones that will make other people happy if I do them.
Yeah.
So now I have a mechanical reason to say, I mean, I can't because, you know, so, this is where I have to be a strong person and say, just learn to say no to this or what, like it puts that into focus in a way that's very actionable to me.
Yeah. I tell people my second favorite word is no, because it keeps me, I'd rather people say no to me than make a promise that,
right.
that then becomes an open loop to me. And so then I just get disappointed. So I'd rather they say no right up front, so I move on. And I try to say no to good and important things every day just to stay in practice. So
yeah. I like that. That's right.
You know, because, yeah, I, you know, I like doing stuff.
So is it intentional that both David Allen and you avoid – you know, you have to stay out of the guru space very actively, I would imagine, and not be promisey of self-help. Like, you could make your companies and books bigger, but that territory seems so gross and, you know, shallow a lot of times, or at least a spectrum of it. But yet you are trying to give people tools to help them with these things that sound very altruistic, and you could turn it into a boastful, you know, you could do it a different way. I'm wondering what limits the way that you message and market and run a business to stay out of that zone.
Well, part of it is, like David tells people, he's the laziest person there is. he didn't do this to be more productive. He did this, you know, to be more present. So he's not trying to be a productivity guru.
Awesome.
He's trying to be more present in his own life, and he's sharing what worked. And
the world class CEOs at the big companies get him for that reason, though.
For productivity, actually, what's so interesting is they're getting him to get more space in their lives. Uh-huh. Because they're in that busy trap. And so they get, there's plenty of people they can go, you know, if they want to work 16, 18 hours a day. David, they go to David if they want to have fewer open loops, which means doing less stuff, which means some of the things were important. David has a great expression, you know, the best way to complete a project is to abandon it, you know, to let it go. And if the universe thinks it's so important, it'll find somebody else to do it. and, you know, we keep trying to do all this stuff because we think we're so important. But, right. But if
that's
you
the,
up,
the part of the fa- that's the phase I'm in right now. When I first found it, I thought I'm going to be able to do everything there is. This is going to be so awesome. And now a year later, I have a very giant and important someday maybe list that I understand. I understand that I won't circle back to. If I go review them, I say, "Oh, I thought that was so important." It's not. It's not. It's not. I mean, I can delete it now. You know.
When I developed my first someday maybe list, I was very pleased to have that. You know, okay, I can take things off the present moment, but not lose them, not have them right in the pile. But then at some point, when I realized how much I could actually accomplish, I looked at the someday maybe list and realized I had more on there than I could accomplish in this lifetime. And that was 20 years ago when I had more lifetime left. So, yeah. Part of it is, and I said to David, you know, I'm encountering my mortal limits with this. And his face kind of went pale and he said, no wonder this is so hard for people. But that's it, you know, where, you know, part of it is just entering into your mortality.
Well, that's one reason people avoid it, I guess. But it's like, yeah, I can actually get a grip on my mortality by, calculating what I won't be able to accomplish in this lifetime. That sounds that's a good feeling in a way. I mean, it's a harder thing to do, but I can understand that as the real work to do at my stage of life, you know?
Yeah, go ahead.
I know, there's a certain grief to letting things go. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So David's book is actually... his original the Getting Things Done was the title the publisher put on it. His original title was The Way of the Peaceful Warrior.
that would have never read that in a million years, you know?
Right? Yeah.
But that's exactly what I'm talking about, because that it's so well done that you don't get the spiritual. I mean, you could it's not spiritual of a book. It's how to do your calendar or something. That's what.
Yeah, it came out of his martial arts practice, you know, where you're present at every moment.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. I'm really glad, really, really glad to get to put a verbal conversation with somebody like you that knows this stuff and thinks about it and knows that, because it's been a big impact on my life. And then your Kairos Cognition is new. Like, it's just launched. I was on the list from Getting Things Done. So I got an email from that and found it and felt like, this is even beyond Getting Things Done in some other areas. So I shared it with Toby and them. I'm very happy to share it with the Bad Christian audience, because I think that for most of us who grew up with a religion, especially a strict one, to guide us, had many good things, but it didn't let us do enough for ourselves a lot of times. And now there's a lot of people unpacking that, and they got to replace it with something. And to me, I think metacognition itself is what would prevent us from just picking up new religions. You know, right. Once we start, you know, deconstructing some of what we've thought, and let us put it back to this allows me to put things back. If just focusing on metacognition itself allows me to put the things back that I want to in the order that I want to, and then add new things too. And it turns out some of this Eastern stuff or other spiritualities, I can take things from them too. And we can all do it from what I would call a mechanical approach. Like I don't use the woo-woo language when possible not to. And the more brain science that we do, and more logic, and the more precise language we use, we don't have to be as woo-woo, but yet we get those benefits of putting a bunch of things together that seem mystical, because they are, you know, they're not right here. They're a little bit more abstract. So mystical fits, but I think it's mechanical, but hard to understand, less mystical.
Yeah, like when you go into that deep space, that sequential but unhooked from time, mm-hmm. it feels mystical.
It does.
But it's right there inside of the deep part of your brain is where it is. I just want to put a cap on something. You asked me back if schools serve people, and yes, there's all of that service, and there's all of that service all over the place. You know, there's all of that service in religion. What's happening is that boy I was telling you didn't need service; he needed empowering.
Yes,
We're serving these kids. We're helping them get the things done that they're supposed to do. But you know, what would happen if we empower them? Well, first of all, it's messy. And you start to empower them, then you know, now you're not as much in control. Service is, you know, it's good, it's nice, it's, you know, it's got nice boundaries around it, it's got rules and order. Empowering is it's dynamic. It can be explosive.
It can bite you in the butt.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Who wants to empower the 3-year-old? What, you know, with what?
Yeah.
How much more power could that? It'd be dangerous to give them too much. So let's not. Let's limit their power.
You know? Yeah, exactly. So it's, yeah. So how do you do that in especially if you're a parent. So I have 2 grown children. How do you empowering a teenager was a scary thing.
Right.
Because you want them to live through teenage.
Right, exactly.
That's where the cool stuff happens.
Yeah. That's what I appreciate so much about your work and what you're doing is it really does feel like you're not solely focused on the outcome, not the just getting the Gold Rush model done or making sure you get the good grade. Like you are literally trying to empower somebody so you don't know the outcome. When you empower somebody, there is no blueprint for what the outcome will be. They get to decide. They're empowered now. They have more choice. They have more ownership of their life. And that's what I really appreciate about what you're doing. It really does feel that way. Like, wait a minute, I'm lost here. I don't know. And if I can gain a little bit about me, then I can make some decisions and choose as opposed to, I just got the job done. Just getting the job done. Really? There's no real growth in that. It gets the job done. I know sometimes maybe that's even needed, but that's what I appreciate about it a lot.
Yeah. Thank you for spending time with us today.
Yeah.
You know, I hope to be in contact with you beyond this, you know, from
yeah,
from
please do. I really appreciate, what you're up to. So, want to hear more about it, listen to more of your music. Some point I'll be able to go to a concert, right?
Yeah, well, I hope so.
Yeah, we have a concert on Wednesday, today. This will come out Wednesday, and we have a concert tonight. It's online, and I'm going to send you the link.
I'll do that,
so you
yeah.
can be a guest at it. We're taking our concerts and doing them at what I think is a pretty high level in a digital format that's kind of new because of the pandemic. So there's a lot of territory there that's just wide open now that people are open-minded to new experiences, and we get to go try to make new experiences for people because of the situation we're in, and it's been really rewarding. So hopefully you would join it. You'll see what we're up to.
Yeah, I would very much enjoy that. I appreciate it. I want to talk more about being bad Christians too at some point. So
okay.
We can get into that.
Plenty of spinoff conversations to have. Thank you for being so generous with your time today.
Sure. My pleasure. Have fun.
Toby, I enjoyed that so much. Thank you for booking Francis. I don't have anything else, but I'm going to go get ready for the stream tonight.
Yeah, I can't wait to see the Weeks in stream tonight. Go to emerymusic.com, get your tickets.
Yep, join Emory Land, join the BC Club. We'll see you on the other side.
Buy stock.
Oh, yeah, and the special goes for 48 hours, so all the way through Friday night, you'll be able to view it. So if you're hearing this at all Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, emerymusic.com. Last time I kept the best spots in place.